Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit. And welcome to the Hobcast, episode number 116. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres:
mysteries,
crime,
thrillers,
and suspense. We really put our efforts into that one.
Well, I was being flat.
Noises off. Welcome to the show. And our guest this week is Louise Mangos.
Yes.
She joins us from Switzerland.
Oh, yes. I mean, lucky her.
Indeed. Probably, and I don't mean this to sound weird, but would you say the fittest guest we've ever had on the show? And I mean athletically.
Not
fit.
Yes, he doesn't mean in the foie way.
No. I mean, look, Louise is very much a woman for the outdoors and has, well, it feels like dozens of outdoor activities that she pursues.
I think she's one of those people who cannot sit still. And I don't mean in a fidgety way like me. I mean she wants to explore the world, see the world, do things, be active. She's got that sort of vibe about her, hasn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. And a writer of psychological suspense fiction. And it was a great interview. We really enjoyed ourselves. We met Louise for the first time in Bristol at Crime Fest. And so, you know, it was nice to reacquaint ourselves, and perhaps we'll see her at Bristol in a couple of months' time. Okay, we'll crack into some news straight away, shall we not?
Yes, let's crack into the news.
Okay, now, out of the stories you've picked out this week, the one that intrigues me is the closure of one of the most prominent book retailers.
Yeah, so I confess I don't know a great deal about this company, but when I'm on Amazon, often the books I want aren't necessarily in print, or they're a little bit more hard to come by. And so when you click on paperback or hardback and it says also offered by these companies, this company comes up quite a lot normally. So Book Depository, they're called.
Yes, I've bought things from them in the past with stuff that is hard to get hold of. Yeah,
yeah. So it's they're basically an online seller, and they were actually bought by Amazon in 2011, which I didn't know.
Right, but they're closing.
They're closing. So yeah.
And why? Why? What's it?
Oh, it's just the usual money, business. But, you know, there's.
An Amazon spokesperson told the bookseller, "We have taken the difficult decision to close the Book Depository following a review across the company to prioritize what matters most to customers and the long-term health of the businesses, of our businesses, rather." The spokesman, hello cat, declined to say how many jobs would go specifically at Book Depository. Well, this is, again, Amazon. They are closing a lot of things down at the moment.
Yeah, and this always happens during economic squeezes, doesn't it? The sort of companies, well, they basically do squeeze themselves. They have to cut away the bits that aren't as profitable for them for whatever reason, because they need to save money. It's a bit like household, isn't it? We do the same thing.
Well, we do. And that's a shame in the sense of it is a useful resource for finding those obscure titles. But increasingly, I noticed today, I mean, I was looking for a particular book, and the cost, if it's not sort of directly in print, the resellers that are getting hold of, I don't know, back copies or whatever they're finding, remainders or stuff that's, the prices have gone shooting up.
And
this book was, I mean, it was 150-odd pages, colour, some colour printing, but it was about £50. I couldn't believe it.
Okay, well, I must admit I haven't looked recently, but I've always almost the opposite to you. I've always been impressed with, they do add on the postage, but I've bought books for sort of £3-4 that, you know, would have been £10 when new. And it, you know, it says good quality, because they always, I like how it does that. It'll tell you something about the quality of the book, so you know what you're getting.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Used, good quality, whatever. Yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting. So they were already part of Amazon's empire anyway, but they're closing with an undisclosed number of jobs lost. But Amazon have shut a lot of distribution centers across the world. Mm. I think the current rate of, I mean, I think it's something like 24,000 jobs have been announced for closure.
Yeah, it just keeps adding up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It keeps totaling up. Well, that's sad. I've got a little story, which I'm just going to look up now, which is going back to my pet hate, which is artificial intelligence.
I was going to say, there's a number of pet hates you have. That's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other pet hates is people not being prepared at the till. So taking half an hour to put something in their purses or whatever.
It depends on the age of the person. And I tend to forgive them if they're elderly.
Oh, no, I don't mind that so much. But I see people who are quite a lot younger than elderly doing that sort of thing. And it hacks me off.
But you know what I get frowned at for?
Yes.
And although I do this is something I do, but I always make sure I'm prepared when it's my turn. I get my book out and start reading if I'm in a queue. People look at me as if they're thinking ahead in the terms you're talking about. I'm thinking, she's not going to be ready when it's her turn.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing about till. I think, why have we gotten to this? I don't know why my mind works like this. When you get to a till and you're still putting things on the conveyor belt, and yet the checkout assistant has already started swiping things through. I hate that.
Well, how do you cope in Lidl then? Is it Lidl? Lidl's one where they go vroom, vroom, vroom.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know that's coming. But I think, you know, I expect better from Waitrose, if I'm sorry. But I really do. Or Marks and Spencer. I really do.
Oh, you know,
you're paying a premium for a slightly better service than that. And this is at a time when it's very hard to find anybody at a till nowadays. You have to do it yourself. Anyway, no, this thing about AI. So chatbots, I still don't understand what all of that is about, to be perfectly honest. But some publishers in the United States are starting to use chatbots to find ways of, you know, discovering keywords, metadata, and stuff that's going to generate interest on their online content and drive traffic to their websites. Because increasingly, these systems are writing articles and blogs and all this sort of stuff.
Yes.
And it's getting quite sophisticated. And actually, it's taking away a lot of traffic from people like us.
Genuine,
real people. And so they're fighting back. And the publishers involved, this is them trying to strengthen their position in their search engine optimization, or SEO, which is, you know, often vital because you really want to be turning up on the first page of Google.
Absolutely.
Publishers like Ingenio, Team Whistle, BuzzFeed, and Gannett are experimenting with how generative AI technology can support their SEO strategies, using it to optimize headlines and keywords for search and to find new topics to create content around to drive traffic. And so they've done this. One TikTok video that Team Whistle used AI to help with research, metadata, and scripting got over 176,000 views. And then a YouTube video that also got the help of AI tools was over 425,000 views.
But what's their normal viewing?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't say that. Mm. And they, let me see, horoscope.com and astrology.com used generative AI since the beginning of 2022, and the publisher is also in the process of producing over 100 articles on the compatibility between each of the 12 signs on horoscope.com using AI.
And do you know, if you look up my sign and your sign,
we're not at all.
In fact, there's usually a big red danger sign at the top.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I've been exchanging messages with an old friend of mine, and she said, "Oh, I thought you'd done the marriage thing. You know, you're thinking of doing it again, are you?" warning shots.
Why?
Well, we're just so incompatible. If people saw how much we'd argued just before we started recording this program, this podcast. You know, they'd be saying, don't do it, love. Just don't do it.
Then that's to you.
To you.
No, to you.
To you. See?
What's if they call me love, I'd probably slap them, so.
All right, love. Well, I've lived in the north for a long time now. And
I've lived in the north all my life.
No, you live in the Midlands. It's different.
Okay.
It's only because when you went to Exeter, everyone thought you were in the north.
They did.
Yeah.
Because I was north of Surrey, so obviously I was a northern.
Oh, yeah. I've never been there.
I've never been to Surrey. Anyway.
Okay, carry on. Yes, you have.
Yeah, so there's just one more story that, I mean, it's happened before and I'm sure it'll happen again. But people who want to work in publishing are very vulnerable. And if they get approached, it's a bit like authors who get approached by companies saying, you know, give me $40 and I will sell your book for film rights or whatever. Their optimism wants them to believe it's real.
Yep.
So Salt Publishing, a small publishing house, bigger than us, but, you know, still in that independent sphere, recently been hit by a scam where the scammers were using the name of the HR director, I think it is, and contacting people with apparently job opportunities as transcriptionists. I don't actually know what that is.
Yeah, well, it's listening to audio and then transcribing.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. Okay. And then just asking them for a whole load of identity information and payment things, you know, like they do. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. People do fall for that.
Yeah.
And it was a complete scam.
Oh, well, so that has, well, presumably done some reputational damage to Salt, whose identity has been used.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
by
that,
scammers.
That could happen to us. It could do.
Well, it's so funny you say that, because there are a lot of adverts now, particularly on the radio, which are talking about, you know, is your business digitally safe and, you know, is it protected properly, and recommending that everyone goes to the government website and tries to stop things. And it is a concern because we've got a lot of intellectual property sitting in our laptops, you know, whether it's people's manuscripts or visual assets or audio assets in my case, you know, and tons and video things and all sorts of things. You know, basically those machines are our, are the, you know, absolute crux and fulcrum of our business. And, there's a lot of info in there that could be very useful to someone, frankly.
So when those little pop-ups come up and they say, ooh, your location is you know, somebody knows where you are, should I actually not just
I'm not so sure. I don't know enough about it, but maybe I should go and investigate. Put that on the list of everything else that is currently on the back burner. Anyway, so that's our news for this week, and be interesting to know what comes out of London Book Fair, which is just over a week away now, and still debating whether we make an appearance for a day and knock some stuff out for the podcast.
Maybe,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it was we found it very difficult last year, and this year will be no different, I'm sure. So that's a debate. And but I mean, there probably are one or two things or groups of people that we would like to grab a word with in terms of the business. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to our interview then with Louise Mangos. And she is another graduate of the crime writing MA mm-hmm. at the UEA. University of East Anglia in Norwich. We counted it, 4 authors who've been through that hallowed portal.
Yes.
on our books. Again. And we also, you know a few more.
Yeah, because they've got a good community spirit, haven't they?
They do. And Louise is one of them. And she has several novels out at the moment. And it was absolutely delightful to catch up with her again. Let's speak to Louise Mangos. How lovely it is to speak to Louise Mangos. Thank you so much for joining us and to see you again.
Oh, well, it's a lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It's brilliant. We met at Crime Fest in Bristol, I believe.
Nearly a year ago.
Yeah. And it's coming around fast. And we gather that you're coming back to Crime Fest. So they obviously didn't scare you off the first time.
They didn't, no. And last year was the first time I moderated a panel. So it will be quite interesting to come back and do the same this year. I'm moderating a panel on the Thursday afternoon, and then I'm a guest on another on Saturday. So it's quite exciting, and it will be great to catch up with the rest of the writing community.
So what I liked about you, your attendance at Crime Fest last year, was you had chocolate. You were giving away chocolate, weren't you?
And it might be that I will bring some more again. I have, yes, it's, I think that was a big hit last year.
It was, yeah. I think I heard people talking about that, like, oh, free chocolate.
Well, I mean, as you live in Switzerland, it is the thing to do. It's either that or bring, you know, dodgy bank accounts, I guess.
It is. I mean, everybody loved that. And it ties in with my brand in a way, because all three of my published books are set at least partly in Switzerland. Two of them are set entirely in Switzerland, and one of them, the main protagonist, lives in Switzerland. So it's appropriate that I should bring the chocolates for the readers.
Cheese next time, maybe.
Yes, might not last as long though.
And, I would hate smelly after a while.
Yes, and then when you're putting it on the table under all those hot lights, you know, it starts melting all over everybody else's little publicity cards. Then it won't be so welcomed, I don't think.
You'll be remembered though.
Yeah, the woman with the cheese, woman with the smelly cheese. Yeah, there you go. That's not bad.
Well, certainly a way to make your mark.
Yeah, because that's what marketing's all about, isn't it?
So
big, memorable.
Anyway. When you, let's just focus on that for a second. So, what are you moderating? What's the subject? Because that's it's such a thing about Crime Fest that always strikes me. And I look down the list, the topics are so wide ranging. It really is extraordinary, just how many aspects of society that can be looked at through the prism of crime writing. So which what's your subject that you have to take
well,
us through?
It's interesting because it is relevant to the book that I'll be talking about there. It's putting your protagonists under pressure, and it's we'll be talking about how much pressure the writer can put their protagonists under without, you know, either undermining their own ability or perhaps making it unbelievable. But the interesting thing is I have three other authors on my panel who have written completely different books. One of them's a police procedural. One of them is a sort of legal domestic noir. And the other one, and I haven't read all of them yet, so I'm just halfway through another one, which is a Scottish police procedural. That's Cara Ramsey's on my panel. So it's Cara Ramsey, Andy Hill, and Kia Abdullah. So interesting groups of books. And I'm already thinking about the questions that I should be putting to these people. And it's actually quite tricky because, you know, when you talk about a protagonist in a police procedural, the protagonist is generally the detective or the DCI. And I mean, they're going to be put under pressure, whatever. So it's, you know, I think maybe I'll have to twist the questions around to talk about some of the other main characters who may be antagonists rather than protagonists. So that'll be great. And then I'm on another panel talking about what motivates people to commit a crime in terms of revenge, money. And that's a panel that's going to be moderated by Steve Mosby, who is Alex
Moore. Oh, yeah.
And lots of interesting authors on that panel, including Andrew Child. So I'll be quite interested to be on that panel.
Well, it, funny you say that, because we said we were going to come to Bristol with our Hobeck blend coffee for Andrew. We promised him, because he's an absolute coffee nut. When we spoke to him last year, we made that promise. So we're going to have to fulfill that
coffee for him.
But yeah, he's terrific. And what I like about Andrew is, you know, clearly they put the new book out at the moment, the latest Reacher, which he and his brother have worked on, obviously Lee, but Andrew does the majority of the heavy lifting nowadays. Just how modest and humble he actually is, and approachable.
Lovely.
Just fantastic.
Really approachable. Just was so, when we all got together and agreed to the panel, he was just so friendly with everybody. And it's, you know, he's quite different from his brother, actually, because I mean, Lee has got to a place in his profession where everybody's looking up to him, and it's you know, people are in awe in his presence. And I think Andrew started out with a very good, he's very approachable, he's very inclusive, he will talk to the fans and people who are interested in getting their books published equally, as well as obviously some of the big names in publishing. So it's a delight to talk to him. So I'm looking forward to that panel.
That's a great panel.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, and Steve's great too, Steve Mosby. And actually, every time we go to a festival, he's always there. And we always say, right, we're going to get you for this podcast. We still haven't done it.
Not yet, so maybe this time.
Yeah, maybe this is our opportunity. But I think it's fantastic, Crime Fest, for that accessibility.
Mm.
More so than Harrogate, and more so than pretty much any other event. I mean, I think Bloody Scotland rivals it. But in terms of just being able to approach somebody, if you've got the courage to do that, and ask for advice. And I think that's one of the great joys of it, isn't it?
It is. I've been to Harrogate as well, and it's huge. I mean, it's so Harrogate is more like it's like a hay festival, or
yes.
You've got people visiting different parts of the panels in tents outside and things like that. Crime Fest, there was a bit of a controversy last year after Crime Fest. Authors were complaining, actually, that why do they have to pay for their tickets if they're going to appear on a panel? And it's like VoucherCon in the US. It's a convention rather than a festival like Hay or Harrogate. And it gives a chance for authors, indie authors, self-published authors, authors who might have not had a new book out for a couple of years. It gives everyone a chance to pitch themselves for a panel. And I think it's a wonderful thing for all ends of the profession, because you get the Andrew Childs and the Ian Rankins and Anne Cleves, but you also get the me's and the people who are just not struggling, but they're on the other end of the scale. They're on the other end of the publishing scale. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And also the conversations, you could argue, a bit more interesting because of that, because you've got people on the same panel with different levels of experience, rather than, Harrogate, they're all sort of similar level.
Well, I think the thing with Harrogate is that everyone's got their rehearsed patter, because they do so many of these festivals. They know, they're so comfortable. And yet, you've got an opportunity to rub shoulders with perhaps bigger names and shine. And I think that's really important. And I think the one thing I would say about to be critical of Crime Fest was that the bar ran out.
Last year, yeah.
Yes.
I they actually out of beer, didn't they?
I think Adrian and Donna felt terrible about that. And I think everybody complained about that. And it was just the post-COVID situation, lack of staff. And I felt terribly sorry for them, because it didn't happen the year before, the previous time that they had Crime Fest in that particular hotel. And so Adrian has promised that he'd do his best to make sure that doesn't happen again. Yes, that is a disastrous thing to happen at a crime festival. Bar close. It's just
that. Too many sober writers. In
well, it felt like, it was the starting point of a murder mystery, because people were
exactly
losing it. But anyway, let's move away from Crime Fest. Let's talk about your career today. And what struck me is there's a bit of a chord here, actually, with a number of our guests in recent weeks who have had their literary careers inspired by an early foray into competition. And in your case, you were quite young when you won a poetry competition, and that seeded your love of the written word. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. Gosh, I was only 11. And I won a poetry competition. It was a poem I wrote for a competition about Mother's Day, and we had to write about our mothers. And it was for the, do you remember Platinum Pens? I don't even know
if
they still exist.
Yeah.
but they had sponsored the competition. It was a national schools competition. And I won first prize in this category. And I was given, my mum got a huge bunch of flowers and I was given a camera. And then my poem was published in the local Hitchin Gazette. And and I was absolutely just, it was so exciting. And I mean, I always even liked writing. The very first time I picked up a pencil and an exercise book, there's a smell you get when you open a new exercise book. I don't know what it is. It's the chemicals in the paper. It's the smoothness of the paper. And I just, every time I open a new one, I stick my nose in it. And I always wanted to just fill books with words. And this poem, the poetry competition certainly was a catalyst to writing some possibly terrible poetry in my teens. And then I started to write short stories. And as I also traveled a lot, I kept journals along my travels. And so writing has always been part of my what I do when I'm not doing active things, writing and reading. But interestingly, I didn't get my first novel published until, I won't tell you how old I was, but that was 2018. So it was a long time after I'd won that first poetry competition. I had actually won other competitions in the meantime for my short stories. And my debut, Strangers on a Bridge, was a finalist in the Exeter Novel Award and was also longlisted in Bath. So I felt like at least I know I can write if people are putting me on shortlists and longlists.
Mm. But you studied creative writing and journalism in the United States.
I did, yes. So that was in my mid-20s. It was quite early on. I thought, I want to write for... I'm a real active person and done lots of sports. I still do lots of sports. And I thought, I want to write for Outside Magazine. This was my big thing in my 20s. I wanted to be a journalist for National Geographic and Outside Magazine. You know, aim high. And so I went and did this... I started out doing journalism, actually, did the introduction to journalism at CU in Boulder. And my teacher came up to me one day and she said, you know, your writing is very, she didn't use the word florid, but she said, it's not quite the stunted necessity for journalism. You need to be short, sharp, punchy sentences for journalism. She said, and I see you writing really beautifully, and I think you should go and do a creative writing course. So it was under her recommendation that I studied poetry and creative writing at CU then, and I didn't stay long enough to actually graduate with anything other than several semesters of credits. And it wasn't until I came back to Europe that I did a couple of sort of week-long writing courses and always keeping up with the trying to improve the craft. And then I went to UEA and did the crime writing. I just latched on to an idea that my stories would have a crime or series of crimes at their heart. And so I thought, may as well sign up to this crime writing course. And I was joyfully accepted. Didn't think I would get on that because I hadn't had, I don't know why I didn't think I'd get on it, but just through modesty, I suppose. But yes, and that's where I met all the other members of the cohort there, including Anthony. So, and that's been a great resource as well.
Absolutely. Anthony Dunford, we're referring to, whose latest book you've read already, and Born the Same. It is coming out in time for Crime Fest.
9th of May.
He's also on a panel.
Yes. So,
I thought, that would have been a good panel for me to be on. His panel is called Location, Location, Location. And of course, his book's set in Central Africa, which is, it's very exciting, very action-packed. And I really enjoyed that read. But I thought, I should be on that panel because my book's set in Switzerland. So we're talking about location, you know, going from Central African, the Congo to the Swiss Alps. That would be an interesting conversation. But no, I was put on another panel, but that's okay.
Well, that's one of the random elements, isn't it? In terms of that UEA experience, and obviously we have a number of our authors who've been through that process and that experience, I should, process is probably the wrong word, but experience is certainly in. We've got Judy Dakin, we've got Wendy Turbin, we've got Lynn LaVersha,
Mark Whiteman
and Anthony Dunford.
Can you name them all?
Yeah. Have I covered everybody? I hope so.
I think so.
It is one of the things that strikes us when we talk to our authors about that experience is that group critical work where, you know, you split off into, I don't know, what, groups of six or something like that. And you are writing for each other and each other's critical process then is applied. That's quite a challenge, isn't it?
Well, it's probably the one resource I say that I've come away with that I felt was most worthwhile. We had some fantastic visiting professors. Our courses were very interesting. But honestly, the greatest thing is meeting these other people who are all at the same level in writing, in their writing careers at the time, and who are all have, you sort of learn how to critique each other's work. After a while, you know what's too much or what's too little. And I think that has been the greatest resource for me. Anthony and I share each other's work. All of them. I mean, Judy as well. She was in our cohort, and Mark was in the year before. But really, that group of 12 writers, there are still six or seven of us who each share each other's work. And we graduated, we finished in 2018. So it's been a while. And 5 years later, we are still helping each other. And it's the best resource.
I love that, though, the fact that when you graduated, it wasn't just that's the end, that actually you're carrying on that relationship.
That bond has,
and it's
been
very valuable because, you know, there are writers who, partly because they're so insecure about their work, but also they haven't got that resource because they haven't got, because it's quite a scary thing, isn't it, to expose your work to people who are quite intelligent, also very big thinkers about writing and the craft of writing. And so was that quite scary the first time you did that?
It was definitely scary the first time I did it. I mean, I'm thinking back to when I wrote my debut, and it took about 8 years for me to write my first book, because it started out as one iteration, and then I started writing a sequel, and then I ended up putting the two books together for one novel. And I didn't have a lot of people I could swap work with or ask to be a critical reader, because at the time I didn't know that many other authors. And there's a difference to having a friend or a member of your family look at your work and having another author or somebody you don't know who has experience in writing look at your work. That two completely different critical eyes, and definitely the former is not a terribly useful resource. I'd say the latter is you have to send your work out to beta readers, and sometimes even to people you don't know is probably the best. And that it's, you have to swallow and say, okay, I'm going to do this, because you know you're going to get back far more useful information than you would if, you know, your mum says, oh, this is really good.
Sounds like my mum.
It doesn't sound like your mum. Your mum would go, why are you wasting your time on this?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, I mean, you know, she's
in terms of art, so, because I know you're an artist as well, so and I've done a fair amount of art. My mum always says to me, why don't you paint flowers and pretty things?
Oh yeah, so it's like I do have people that look at a picture and, oh, I could do with a little bird there. No.
So I think my mum's gonna go to a grave hoping that I would just paint pretty things, not these blobs, as she calls them.
Yeah, well, your art is fantastic too. A lot of landscapes there that I had a quick look through your gallery.
I just say my favourite is, I think it's the red peppers.
Oh, really?
I love that one.
So I was walking through a market in Barcelona, and it was the Santa Caterina food market, which is just the most amazing place for colour inspiration, and there was this massive pile of peppers that had been so artistically placed like that was actually from a photo, And they really were placed like that. And yeah, I love painting things like that. I think I'm going through a water and mountain stage at the moment. I love painting lakes and rivers and waves. And we've just come back from New Zealand, and I have a whole load of material that I'm going to start working on for new canvases soon. I do have an attic full of canvases. I don't sell as many paintings as I do books, so I'm not quite sure how long.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I had the same problem when we moved here. I actually had to throw a lot away because we just had nowhere to put all my old art.
I know. Well, I think I'll start painting over them. And maybe one day, long after I've gone, somebody will find something in the attic and go, oh, there's a real masterpiece underneath
this one. Oh, you'll be on that program. What's that program called? BBC program with Fiona Jobbies, I think it is.
Fiona Bruce.
Where they is it a fake? Is it real? There's a painting underneath.
Yeah, go through the layers. No, it's fantastic. Where would you assess, you know, now that you've got the course 2018, three novels published now, where would you assess your career to date? I mean, how would you assess, and what are your plans for future books?
Okay. Well, you've caught me at a very interesting period in my career to date, because it has been like riding a roller coaster. It really has. I'd say I'm still evolving, and I've learned so much about publishing over the past 4 or 5 years. My first two books were published by a digital first publisher, HQ, and my third book was published by Red Dog, Sean Coleman. And all three of them have been on their own little roller coasters. And last year, I completed the reversion of the rights back to me. And I've been learning about self-publishing. And I got myself an agent, and she said, look, we don't want to lose the reviews of all these books. So what you need to do in the meantime is pop them up on Amazon, and the reviews, transfer the reviews over to those ebooks. And then she said she would find homes for my backlist. So in the meantime, I also have two books out on submission to regular publishers. But what has happened in the meantime is I've taken control. I feel very empowered. And I thought, invest a little time in advertising these books. And holy moly, I start earning money from these books. And it's become it's a new point in my career where I think, well, why don't I try this hybrid thing? I have a colleague in Switzerland, Linda Huber, who's one
Linda.
Of the, yes.
Oh,
she's
Linda.
One of your most successful authors. And she is successful because she's a hybrid author. And I think her self-published books do equally as well. She has a great following. She's built her audience. And I'm in that process right now of deciding whether to my latest works, whether they should continue to be submitted to traditional publishers, or whether I want to go ahead and do this indie thing. So yeah. I'm in an interesting period, and I haven't decided for sure. But the books are selling well, and I think, well, why not go for paperbacks too? Because I know they're not everyone's favorite platform, but Amazon do sell books, and it's the most accessible for a lot of people. Not necessarily advocating everybody should do that, but it's for people, you know, it might be for people who are having difficulty getting onto the big five publishing ladder, which is very challenging in today's day and age.
The publishing landscape is so different now to how it was even 10 years ago. I mean, Linda Huber's a really good example. So she's published three books with us, but she is so prolific, isn't she? She's got sort of her backlist titles as well, but and she's doing other genres, and she's really good at the advertising and the promotion. We think she should give a masterclass, actually.
She's helped me a lot because more recently, for example, I just saying about having to invest in advertising, and my Amazon advertising didn't seem to be having a great return on investment. So she said, well, you must go and try Facebook again. So, and remember to tweak your audiences. And she's very helpful. And sure enough, right now, Facebook advertising seems to be the one that's working. So it changes. As you say, the landscape's changing. Not only is the landscape changing, the marketing landscape is changing all the time. And honestly, I don't know, whatever sells books this week, maybe next week it'll be something completely
different.
And that's so hard, isn't it? Because we find that as well, that I set up a Facebook campaign a couple of weeks ago for one of our series and it just flopped. And I'd followed all the methods that I knew. And so I completely changed how I've done it this week and hoping it'll work. Yeah, well,
fingers crossed, because the only other thing I would have to say is anyone that gets into indie public, like self-publishing, there is a lot of time consuming admin to do. And unless you keep on top of those ads, that it can get away from you. And so I can't imagine what it's like for Hoback as an indie publisher to keep control of all your authors on every, you know, in all the platforms, and authors who have different books. Each book has a different advertising campaign. Mm. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah. You're telling me.
Yeah, and there's TikTok as well. I've started using TikTok. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, that is our challenge. That is our number one challenge. And in a way, it's a funny thing. This is something that we always come back to, which is this the point I make sometimes, which is essentially Hoback, and indeed any publishing company, its principal job now is the marketing. And that's the hardest thing to keep abreast of and keep making it work. Indeed, sometimes it just doesn't, and you can spend a lot of money delivering very little, and that's very, very wary. But that is the nature of it. I mean, all the other stuff that you do, supporting authors and all the production process and the editing and all that stuff, is all very important, and you know, take that as written that you can do that.
That's the fun stuff.
And that's the stuff that draws you. You get drawn towards that, and the other stuff is a chore, really.
Yeah.
It's just frustrating. I enjoy marketing. I enjoy it. But
when it works,
I find it frustrating.
It's really nice when it works. I think I make a campaign and then I see those graphs start rising next week, and that's, oh yes, I'm selling books. And then suddenly it just, for no reason at all, the buyers drop off. And it's like, oh gosh, what am I going to do to get them back up again? You know, what? So, you know, I do a couple of Instagram posts, or I don't know if that works. I don't know if Twitter works. I think anything you throw money at should work, because everyone should be winning. But in terms of, it is tough. It's really tough, but it's not so fun as writing. For me, it's not as fun as writing the book. I quite enjoy looking at, for example, I designed my own cover for my second book, The Art of Deception, and I quite like it. But I've asked a lot of people and they go, well, it doesn't really follow the tropes that people are looking for in that kind of book. So although I like it because I'm an artist and I think, oh, that looks very artistic, I have to be careful and see whether that cover will actually sell, or whether I need to look at putting, you know, I don't know, I hate to say it, but a girl in a red coat on it or something like that.
But I mean, that's a problem we have all the time, isn't it? Because me also being artistic, and we tend to go on gut feeling, but then I send it to the heart team and sometimes they say, I wouldn't have picked it up in a bookshop. I wouldn't have known it was about that. And I think, oh.
And I like doing that too. And I think, well, who do I ask? You know, I need to ask a publishing expert, and all the cover specialists, of course, are going to take your money before they decide whether your book cover, if they can give any advice on your book cover or suggest one of their own. So it's actually quite an expensive part of the process, I think. But the cover design is so important.
Mm,
I think you're right. Crucial. You know, people you have to ask people whether they're going to pick that up in a bookshop or even pick it up on Amazon when they click, you know, do they like that cover? Does it make them click? One week it works and one week it doesn't for me. So I'm looking at that very carefully at the moment, covers.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably the most important decision one makes.
Well, when I worked in publishing, the covers meetings that we used to have were terrifying because the poor designer would be stood at the front with his, look what I made. And the salespeople would say, yes, can't have that. We're not going to be able to sell that. We can't take that to the bookshops. They'll just laugh at us. It'd be really brutal.
That is brutal because if you think about it, the cover designer is an artist, as the writer is an artist creating words, cover designers creating a cover. You'd think that they could be a little bit more gentle about suggesting things for those covers. But no, I can imagine that happens actually. And I have to say, though, Anthony's covers, I love his cover, and the designer's done a great job on his books.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Jane is ace.
Yeah, she did. And I think we'll look again at Hunted because, in a sense, you know, Jane as a designer, it was one of her earliest designs, if not her first. And now she's developed, in fact, it was her second because after Robert Dawes.
Yeah, so she'd done Robert Dawes and Anthony.
Yeah, but I think that the new one is absolutely spectacular.
It's beautiful. I can't stop looking at it.
Yeah.
So orange is my favourite colour, which means that, of course, I'm going to pick that up in a bookshop. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why we did that. so we can get one sale at least. No.
You'll get more than that.
Not that bad.
No, not at all. You were saying, you know, clearly at a junction where you're making a decision as to where to place your creativity. But in terms of that creative process, you're out and about a lot in terms of, you know, you're talking about your sporting interests and taking advantage of the fact you're in the Alps or near the Alps. Do ideas strike you while you're doing all that sort of thing, the mountain lifestyle?
Oh, they do. Interestingly, yesterday, it's really cold and horrible here at the moment, by the way, and we don't have snow, but it's cold. So I can't do anything outside at the moment. Cycling, I froze my toes off cycling the other day. And yesterday I went for a swim, a really long swim in our local pool. And I've been thinking about my fourth work, which is I've kind of got two or three works in ready to be submitted. But something was niggling me about my fourth work. It's a psychological suspense again, and it has a group of six people in it. It's called Six Fatal Flaws, and a psychotherapist baby goes missing, and all six, including her, so five of her former patients and her, come under suspicion, and it goes through each of the characters, how each of them could possibly have been guilty of this crime. But at the end, when we find out who it is, my resolution didn't feel exciting enough. And I was trying to think what on earth I could do to make it a little bit more exciting. I've been thinking about it for months. And yesterday I was swimming and ding, ow, after about a kilometer, I just had this revelation, and I've come home and I've typed all these notes, and I'm going to be rewriting the last couple of chapters of that book. So I'm very excited, and that happens often. So I've spent, you know, most of the day, writing day, on my bum in front of the laptop and writing lots of words. And you can get too desk bound. And the imagination needs to flow. So that's going off to do my sports is definitely part of the writing therapy. And I could not do without it. So when I'm stuck or when I think, oh, I don't know where to go with this chapter, go for a walk, go for a swim, go for a bike ride, go for a cross-country ski. And really, I always come back with some kind of solution. So, yeah, I definitely need that in as a kind of aid or a therapy to my writing.
I love that cross-country ski is in the same list as swimming and cycling. And if only.
Yeah, I haven't been able to do much this year though. I mean, I'm this is a bit of a My husband is a Kiwi, and we go to New Zealand for 6 weeks or so each year. So this February, we went to New Zealand. I missed out in the entire snowy bit of our winter because we've had a really short winter in the Alps. And I've actually only cross-country skied twice this entire season. And I really missed it. But, you know, swapping that for a beach in New Zealand isn't such a hardship.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, sort of.
Lots of open water swimming. No,
New Zealand, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. We've got to the point now.
Oh, have we?
We have,
It's
kind
of related as well to the question.
Oh, good. Well, in which case I shall give it the build up. Rebecca's random question.
Right. I want you to consider all forms of the following when you tell me your favourite. What is your favourite mode of transport and why?
Well, of course, I should say skis, but it's not really a mode of transport.
I consider anything that gets you from A to B, whether it's fast, slow, driven by someone else or yourself.
Otherwise, I'm going to say kayak.
Oh, really?
So, yes. I've done... Chris, my husband, and I did a lot of river kayaking before we had children. Then when we had children, I considered it a little bit too dangerous. So now we do ocean and lake kayaking. And I absolutely love kayaking between islands or across our lake. That's probably my favourite mode of transport. Completely unmotorised, human powered, and also water. I love being near water. I'm a water baby.
I was going to say, I get a sense of that you're drawn to water.
It's interesting with the kayaking thing. I mean, because I have the world's tightest hamstrings. It's so difficult for me to get into the boat, let alone then stick it out. Because lower back goes and everything tightens up, and I'm in a world of pain. The last time I tried it was in the sea at Swanage in Dorset, and I managed to miss getting in. Just slid off the back, the side, and you know, full immersion in the sea, to the merriment of my kids.
That's the hardest thing, though, is getting in and out of the thing. It's always the hardest part. Probably getting out is even harder than getting in, I would say. Because you can slip in, but getting out, you have to sort of make sure your paddle is flat against the jetty so that the boat doesn't tip. And then you've got to push yourself up. So I think getting out is even harder than getting in.
Yeah.
They need strong arms.
Well, I mean, I can't even get out of our bath at the moment because it hasn't got any handles or anything. So that's, you know, that's out. I'm a shower man now as a result.
What's your favourite mode of transport then? I always say the question.
I don't use it enough.
Actually say he must not get into a kayak.
That ain't happening. I mean, you know, if it's waterborne, then my favourite form of transport is a punt.
Cambridge.
The Cambridge thing, and I was one of the few people in my sort of sixth form college who could punt, and I took quite a long time to master. Once you got the steering right, it's dead impressive when you're taking your friends out for a punt and, you know, steering out of all the trouble when you see all the tourists sideways across the river and all that sort of thing, and you're able to just elegantly steer your way around it. And
did you use it to entice the ladies?
I was going to get to that. Yes. Yes.
I was going to say that is always the attractive thing. A boater and those Cambridge guys, handsome when they're punting up and down the canal.
Yeah, that was my kind of shtick. But my party trick was to, while punting, I would there was a bridge. If you go out towards Grantchester, so there's two parts of the rivers, the upper river and the lower, and the backs that everyone knows through the colleges. But you go out on the upper river to Grantchester, a beautiful place with the water meadows and all that sort of thing. There's a bridge, a footbridge, that crosses the river. And if you're, when I was younger and stronger and lighter, I was able to put the pole lengthways in the boat, pull myself up over this bridge while the boat's traveling, because I've given it enough momentum, and I'd be able to time it so that I would jump over the bridge and jump back into the boat without toppling it, and then resume punting.
That's a pretty good party trick.
That was my party trick, yeah. It just beggars belief that I could do that now.
Yeah, see a repeat of this.
It's not going to happen.
Next time I just ask, though, Did you have 100% success rate with that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've never fallen in the camp. Fallen in the camp.
How about with the ladies? Did they go, oh, that's amazing. Let's go on a date.
There's always someone who's going to be impressed by something like that, especially if you've what you do is you fill up with jugs of Pimm's at the mill pub, which
of
is
course.
Sort of equidistant between the, you know, it's right on the sort of apex of the two different rivers.
Yeah.
And then when you get to Grantchester, you jump out, go to the Green Man and refill your jugs. And then so you do a couple of lengths. And by that point, someone's going to be impressed by that little trick. So
are you still able to do it after a couple of jugs of Pimm's?
Just about.
yes, indeed.
Well, the other trick was to actually get one of the girls to punt, and then they realised just how skilled
that's
you know, because you're going sideways and crashing into.
Especially
if there's a little elbow in the river, Cam, called the Devil's
Elbow,
Devil's Corner, and it's where you can't. The pole is too short to reach the bottom, and it always catches the unwary out. So they lose their poles, and they get stuck in the. You know, they literally push it down, and it doesn't go, and they just floats off downriver, and
it's like a pole graveyard.
Yeah, and so that was always the point where I used to give control of the boat to somebody. Just to make it look even more impressive.
Crafty.
Oh, it's terrible. But I did take my, sorry about this. I did take my son's canoeing, not kayaking, but it was kind of the Canadians, you know, kneeling down version.
Yeah.
And my little lad, James, at the time would have been about 5, I think.
Oh, that's young.
Yeah. And we got to Devil's Corner and we'd been winding him up that this is where the devils live. I got my other son, Ben, who was 8, we both chucked our paddles, pretended to lose them, and drifted into Devil's Corner, at which point James was so scared that the devils were going to... He jumped into the river in his...
Oh, you meanie.
Yeah.
Oh,
bless him.
That's so mean.
That is really mean.
Absolutely terrible. He was wearing, obviously, a life jacket, and we managed to haul him back in, but yeah. Anyway, what's your favourite form of transport?
Well, I do love skiing, but mine is my micro scooter, which I haven't got out for a while, but I used to scoot everywhere on it. So
yeah, we have loads of those in Switzerland. I've seen them all over. Now they were actually the most I'd seen dead micro scooters in New Zealand. They just, people stop and leave them in the middle of the street. And they're now talking about e-rubbish, you know, having these e-bike rubbish. It's like it's just all over. You can't walk down a pavement without having to step over scooters that have just been left there by, because they have these companies that you know.
I know, yeah, like the Boris bikes.
On your phone and rent them out. And just everywhere. But yeah, they look like a lot of fun. I think I'd tell, if my kids had one of those today, I'd definitely be telling them they have to wear helmets and elbow pads and knee pads and everything. They look pretty dangerous. I think they can go quite fast.
So there was one particular hill. I did my art degree in Wolverhampton. So I would take my scooter on the train and then scoot from the train station to the art building. And there was one slope. And I would just like, zoom down that slope. But yeah, quite dangerous now when I think about
it. Well, it's funny, we could all, I'll tell you what we can do when we go to Bristol, we can get the e-scooters out because it's a big thing there.
Is it?
Yeah, massive. Yeah, going past our hotel, you know, e-scooters, and there's e-scooter lanes and everything. So it's a really big deal in the middle of Bristol. So we should have a crack at that.
We'll do that. Yeah, it's a lot of traffic though. I don't know if I'd like to be scooting in and out of that heavy traffic around Bristol.
No, not at all. But, you know, we'll see. Okay.
We could scoot in the hotel lobby. That'd be good.
I don't know if you'd be very popular.
Andrew Child on an e-scooter.
Knock Andrew Child over. That would be a bit.
Actually, I think Anne Cleves is going to be a devil on one of those things. She'll be good.
She would so go for a scooter, wouldn't she? She would. That.
Yeah, she would. It's been an absolute pleasure, Louise. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online?
So people can find me online at louisemangos.com, www.louisemangos.com, but they can find my books on the big A, Amazon. And there are 3 books there at the moment, 4th one possibly coming soon. And yes, more books in the pipeline. So
excellent.
Yes.
Fantastic.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, scooting on e-scooters around Bristol is in prospect in just over a month's time.
E-scooter business, normal scooters.
Well, I know you were talking about normal scooters, but I think that cross wires there.
Yes, but although I think Louise could cope with a normal scooter.
Oh, I'm sure she could. I don't think the normal scooter could cope with me, although I am a little bit less bulky than I was.
Yes, you are disappearing in front of my eyes because you are not eating much in the way of carbohydrates at the moment.
No, I'm not. It's been amazing, actually.
Last night we had pasta meatballs and I spiralised a courgette for you.
You did.
And do you know what? My right arm is now bigger than my left arm. I'm not kidding.
No, I think you're right. No, you've been amazingly supportive. But I basically got a kick up the behind from my diabetes nurse.
Literally, I have photos.
And that was about 6 weeks ago now. And the changes that I've made since that day, and I have to give great credit to her because she spent an hour with me going through everything. I mean, you know, why do I eat the certain things I was eating and have done for decades? And somehow, for the last 6 weeks, managed to pretty much stay on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of times when you've almost wobbled, but to your credit, you've pulled yourself away from the wobble and just got on with it.
Yes, that's true.
Now, we had donuts in the house a couple of days
ago. It's still sitting there, the one with my name on it.
And what I like about you is the fact you look at me and you say, there's donuts. As if I say, oh, have one. That stops you feeling guilty, so I don't say it.
No, it's been amazing. I mean, one of the eyes on the prize is that we are set to get married in December, and I really don't want the photos reflecting, Beauty and the Beast. You being Beauty and me being the Beast. I want to sort of shrink to fit into a suit. And I have a certain set of measurements in mind that I've got to get down to.
That makes me think of that Wallace and Gromit scene where he sort of falls into the suit.
Into the wrong trousers.
Wrong trousers, that's it. Wrong trousers, sorry.
Yeah, you're right. In terms of our week to come, it's pretty much the usual. The kids are been with us for Easter, which has been lovely. But, it'll be feel very empty without them around.
Yeah, it will, but I've got plenty to occupy myself with.
Yeah, you've got so much on at the moment, as usual, and I have too. I've got to finish my last of the Legionary books, which I've been telling you about. And I really hope that in the near future we can get the author, Gordon Doherty, to join us on the programme.
So there's one bit of exciting development. There's a piece of exciting development in Hobet Books that I've been working on quietly in the background. We've just taken over the Henshaw Press short story competition. And this is a competition that runs four times a year. And people are invited to submit short stories of up to 2,000 words on any subject they like. Could be cats, could be wheelie bins, anything. And there's a prize. First prize is £200. Second prize is 100, I think. And third prize 50, every four times a year. And we're taking on this challenge. And so I'm a bit nervous, but excited as well.
I'm just resisting the words to say, we are.
happily oblivious, aren't you?
No, well, yeah, I've been in a bit of a bubble, my narration bubble, for so long now. And my voice is a bit croaky today because I did just done two mega chapters and I want to get two more done before close of play as we record this today. And it has been a bit all-consuming, really. It's in a very positive way, but at the same time, there is a growing to-do list on all sorts of aspects of life, not just to do with the business. And I'm looking forward to writing that down sometime in the next week and getting on top of it. But yes.
So the first one that we are in charge of opens on the 1st of May, but details on our website.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can't wait for that. So somewhere along the line, in terms of we've got to read our submissions, and now we have short stories to.
I know. And one of our authors, I'm not going to mention who, emailed me yesterday saying, I've just finished the next book. If I send it to you, can you read before Crime Fest? And I said, yeah. So we have lots to read. Lots to read.
Yeah. Well, that's great because there's a never ending supply of fresh material. But I have got a to be read pile of many thousands of books on top of that. But yeah, reading for pleasure. Who needs that? Well, look, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you all. And thank you for joining us again for the Hobcast Book Show. We are still slowly cogitating and working our way through what we're going to do with the show to take it to a new level.
So that's also on your to-do list.
Yeah, and that is very much on my to-do list. And I am looking forward to, in May actually, there is the big sort of podcast show in London, which I think would be very valuable in terms of seeing where the industry is going, because we're part of it. We are part of it. This podcast is a significant chunk of our sort of creative effort.
Absolutely. Highlight of my week.
Yeah, as you say. The opportunity for us to fight before we switch the microphones on, which is great. But anyway, thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get it from. And also to look at our website, www.hobeck.net. And all the details of our authors, our books, audiobooks, etc., all there. And we'd be delighted if you go and have a little look. Sign up to our newsletter and get your free copy of Crime Bites.
And also my weekly Sunday musings,
which I can't wait to read a little later when you've written them. Thanks so much for joining us. My name's been Adrian Hobart.
And my name is still Rebecca Collins.
Not for much longer, a few months' time. And
maybe.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks so very much. And I'll leave you with the very warm words of we hope you have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.